Welcome to the Strategy Driven Editorial Perspective Podcast, where we examine the marketplace uncertainty created by today's headline events and the actions business leaders should take to ensure their organizations succeed under these circumstances. Today, I am joined by Lewis Reynolds, author of America the Prisoner. Lewis will share his thoughts on America's seemingly endless need for foreign oil and the actions business leaders should take to strengthen their organizations while helping end our addiction. And so now, without any further delays, let's get started. We are privileged to be joined by Lewis Reynolds, author of America the Prisoner, The Implications of Foreign Oil Addiction and a Realistic Plan to End It. Lewis has spent years as a financial advisor and consultant to a wide range of companies, particularly in the energy industry. His billions of dollars worth of transaction and advisory experience, background in economics, and passionate desire to help renew America's promise provides a unique perspective on our energy dilemma. Working with pioneer energy companies, he has gained inside knowledge of the technology that can change our world. Lewis, welcome to the Strategy Driven Editorial Perspective Podcast.
Thank you, Nathan. It's a privilege to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. As we talked about before we started our recording, I, of course, have worked in the nuclear business for the last 18 years, so I share your passion for energy and the energy industry. So really thrilled to have a kindred spirit join me on our editorial perspective. Lewis, to start out our conversation, I think all of our audience members are going to agree with us that our country has an addiction to foreign oil, and we've had this addiction for quite some time. What do you see as the significant issues the addiction brings with it?
Well, Nathan, there are, of course, environmental consequences. Those are probably in the forefront of most of your audience members' minds because we've recently experienced the tragic spill in the Gulf of Mexico. But that really is, in my mind, a second place to the important issues that emerge when you look at the cash flows associated with foreign oil addiction. In a year where prices are towards the top end of the spectrum that we see, we're shoveling somewhere around $600 billion a year to overseas interests from the pockets of American consumers and American businesses. Mm-hmm. And that's a very dangerous sum of money to be sending overseas, particularly when you look at what those cash flows wind up paying for. One of the things that they pay for is probably not going to surprise anyone, which is military buildup in Middle Eastern countries and Venezuela with Hugo Chavez in Russia and other places that are not generally friendly to the United States. But probably the most disturbing thing is that about 44 cents of every dollar we spend on foreign oil is ultimately used to purchase assets in the United States. And what we see when you look at the cumulative effect of that is that in 1986, a very important statistic kind of flipped for us, and that was the difference between assets that Americans own abroad versus assets that foreigners own in the United States. And throughout most of our history, that number was positive, but it switched negative, and foreigners began to acquire more assets in the U.S. In 1986 than we owned abroad. And now that figure has risen to $3.5 trillion, and it continues to rise every year. And that's a particularly scary statistic. But there's also an important fact when you look at what assets are being purchased. Out of that 44 cents of every dollar we spend on foreign oil, half of that amount of money is being used to acquire, let me be clear, specifically in the years 2003 through 2008, which is what most of my research focused on, and that's presented in my book. During those years, about half of the money that was used to acquire American assets went specifically into the securities of Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and the U.S. Treasury. And the impact on the country was to help create more credit for the housing industry and for consumers buying housing than otherwise should have been created. It certainly contributed to the housing crisis. It did at that point and continues to depress long-term interest rates relative to their natural levels. And I don't think that is a consequence of foreign oil that most people are aware of.
Oh, I would agree. In fact, you know, I like to think, again, being a member of the energy industry and admittedly a proponent of nuclear power, and one of the things we tout in favor of nuclear power, of course, is that it's a domestic energy source. All of those things that you just mentioned, I wasn't aware of before we've had our interaction. I wasn't aware of the fact that in 1986 that there was that flip in us owning assets abroad versus foreigners owning assets here. And that is alarming. I usually thought of it just as terms of the trade deficit with us and foreigners and not liking my money going to Middle Eastern countries, as you said, were buying arms. But I hadn't fully appreciated all of the other financial ramifications.
Well, sure. And the trade deficit is particularly scary. But when you look at what makes up the trade deficit, more than half of it, in fact, 65% of it in 2008, was comprised of foreign oil. I think most people believe that importing consumer products from places like China is the main cause of our trade deficit. But in reality, if you look at specifically what components make it up, foreign oil is by far the largest contributor.
Wow. And again, that's just a number that I don't hear spoken of very often. So, Lewis, from your perspective, what do you think that we as a nation should do to end our addiction to this foreign oil?
Nathan, there are some wonderful technologies out there that again, I think you will be surprised to hear about, because they're not things you hear about every day, even if you're in the industry as you have been. Nuclear certainly can help in electricity production, but I tend to think of foreign oil and electricity production as being two separate markets, because the oil that we import goes almost exclusively to transportation, whereas electricity, at least at this point, is not powering transportation to a large extent. Now, that may change in coming years as we get to have more electric cars and plug-in hybrids and other vehicle options that can take advantage of nuclear power. And I have to point that out, because it's been pointed out to me that nuclear power could be a substitute for foreign oil. But at least at this point, most of our vehicle fleet runs off of petroleum-based fuels or liquid fuels respect. So the technologies that are available to us now, we're familiar with ethanol in this country that's been produced from corn. That's not the best technology for us to be investing in, and the reason for that is quite simply that corn is very land-intensive.
Yes.
So to grow corn, you only get about 3 bushels per acre per year, or excuse me, 3 tons per acre per year, and that's really not enough to impact our foreign oil addiction, even if vast reaches of the U.S. were planted in corn that are not already devoted to agriculture. In fact, I think the statistic is somewhere around 35% of the land area of the U.S. would have to be planted in corn to get enough to displace all foreign oil. And because of climate considerations and the fact that land is used for many other things, and we would have to cut down forests and so forth, that's just not a feasible alternative. So that leaves us, fortunately, there's a technology where you may be familiar. It's called gasification. And gasification basically can transform basically any organic material, whether it be coal or biomass, natural gas or petroleum sludge or basically anything that has carbon and hydrogen in it, into very simple molecules that can then be reassembled into fuel through a fuel synthesis process. And this technique was used in Germany during World War II. It produced about half the fuel that was produced in Germany during that time. And it also has been used extensively in South Africa and is still used extensively in South Africa. It emerged because of their isolation from international oil markets as a result of apartheid policies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they've proven that it can be done economically. But in more recent innovations in catalyst technology and gasification technology and even nanotechnology has rendered this this process even more economical. And based on the research that I've done and plants that are already operating out there now, we can grow biomass and specifically high-yielding biomass that produces about 12 times the yield on a per acre basis as corn, or we can use coal, assuming that we can get around the fact that there's a lot of carbon discharge associated with that, and produce fuel for about $1.25 a gallon, which is less than the current wholesale price of gasoline, and that's very important.
Yes. Oh, it's extremely important. And I know that there's a lot of business leaders out there that are very concerned that the solutions that are currently being proposed to get us off of our oil addiction could severely damage their businesses and make them non-competitive, especially on the world market. Lewis, I was wondering if there were some actions that you believe business leaders themselves should take to both help their companies, as well as our country, get off of our oil addiction, but that would also at the same time help improve their organization's bottom line.
Well, when you talk about tactics that could damage businesses, I think you're probably talking largely about climate change legislation and carbon tax or carbon cap and trade or regulation of carbon discharge in some form.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly can be very costly for businesses and probably would be very costly for businesses. I know when we were evaluating the potential cost of Kyoto, which fortunately we never subscribed to, the cost would have been on the order of almost as much as what corporations pay in income taxes.
So, oh, wow.
You're not talking about small amounts of cost here. Now, I don't know what regime might be proposed in the future by the government or the EPA or whoever winds up bringing out legislation. I don't know if you know this, but the EPA is currently preparing to regulate carbon even without legislation. So it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. But it really depends on where you set the cap level as to what the costs are going to be. Now, Kyoto was particularly dangerous because the caps were simply too high, too low, and the cost too high. And there were certainly structural considerations within Kyoto that disadvantaged the United States relative to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Russia, for one, was... there is essentially a built-in transfer payment where the whole structure of the treaty was based on us buying allocations from Russia. We would pay them not to produce, which they stuff that they weren't producing anyway, and that's how we got them to basically subscribe to the treaty. And, of course, China was not even a party to that treaty, so they are now the largest energy consumer. They surpassed us this year. So Kyoto was basically a disaster in the making, and I really hope that if there is going to be climate regulation in the future, that it will take a form that's more friendly to business. And I think business leaders need to be proactive, call their customers, and make sure that their voices are heard and when these legislations are being crafted.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very important. But the other thing that business leaders can do is look for opportunities to invest as these opportunities come along within the new energy scheme. Certainly things are going to be changing in the energy world one way or the other. You're essentially running out of oil on a worldwide basis. I don't know if you know this, but worldwide oil production has been essentially flat since 2004 after growing essentially year over year since the first oil well was drilled. So the phenomenon of peak oil that many of us have heard so much about may very well be upon us. And meanwhile, demand is growing in places like China exponentially. So that can only spell very high prices on world markets when you have supply constrained and demand growing.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, economics 101. So there are certainly going to be opportunities for business leaders to invest. And one of the examples I like to cite that will give some perspective to hopefully some of your audience members is the example of Tyson Foods. And Tyson, you know, clearly produces chicken and other foods, but they have a tremendous volume of waste associated with that. There's things like skin and chicken feathers and, you know, fat and grease that comes from the production process.
Sure.
And Tyson has partnered with a company called Centroleum, and they're building a plant right now, which I think will be coming online in less than 12 months, that will produce fuel from the chicken parts. And I'll bet that some of your audience members out there work for companies that have similar kinds of waste that isn't being utilized. You know, there's certainly so many options out there for construction debris and, you know, wood mill residue. There's paper plants have been looking for ways to use the waste associated with the paper production process
mm-hmm.
to produce fuel. And there are many, many ways that business leaders can look to find ways that their particular business can fit into the new way of producing energy, which is going to be ways other than petroleum, hopefully.
Now, Louis, to tie all that together, do you see any specific business sectors or maybe business offerings that organization leaders ought to be looking at as potential opportunities in light of our move away from oil?
Well, I certainly believe that there are going to be tremendous opportunities in energy agriculture and synthetic fuel production. There are companies out there that are public companies now that are focusing on some of these. Many of them are a fairly early stage. I don't want to be a stock picker, so I'm not going to tell you the names of these companies. I'll let you find out for yourself. But as far as being in a particular sector, I recently wrote an article for an online magazine where I talked about, you know, wouldn't it have been great if you could have invested in Microsoft in the mid-80s? Or been on the front end of the dot-com bubble and gotten out just in time. You know, there's so many, you know, great investment opportunities that many of us might have missed. Well, this is one that I hope people don't miss because the next great fortunes will be made in alternative energy. Because as I pointed out earlier, the supply and demand dynamics associated with oil are just creating an environment where petroleum is going to become less a factor in our transportation and energy lives, and something else is going to take that place. And those investment opportunities are something that should be seized immediately because there's just essentially no way to lose. Americans are not going to stop traveling. Goods are not going to stop being shipped around our country. And we need to hopefully identify ways to profit from that on the front end, and there are many ways to do that.
Well, Louis, I want to thank you not only for your time, but for sharing your insights on America's oil addiction and how business leaders can help solve this problem while at the same time enhancing their bottom lines. So thank you again for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Nathan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the Strategy-Driven Editorial Perspective Podcast. We've shared our view and invite you to share yours at www.strategydriven.com. Until next time, so long.